We continue our conversation on Dig Deep today about jobs. In our last segment, we looked at where jobs came from, what was done to create them. I'm Heidi Holton, and joining me on Dig Deep, conservative commentator Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, liberal commentator Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown. Chuck, why don't you kind of begin this conversation about kind of modern times of jobs versus work? And you said productivity?
Yeah, it was very interesting because when I first traveled to Europe, I had this eye-opening moment because I was very much in the mindset of the more we can increase productivity, the more we can lower prices for people, the better off that everybody's going to be. And I'm an engineer, so I look at, you know, building roads. How can we get the most machinery and lay this blacktop as, you know, as quickly and efficiently as possible? And if we can get it to where we don't have to have four people on the machine but only three, that's going to lower the cost and free up money for other things. I'm very much in the mindset of, you know, how do we deploy this capital to the greatest amount of productivity? And I'm over in Italy and I'm looking at this road crew. And first of all, they have like four times the number of people that we do on a road crew. And they're moving at this like glacial pace, putting things together. And I'm thinking, how in the world does this work? And I started talking to people and, you know, they were getting paid decent wages. And I realized that like, things just moved more slowly. And I got back over here and I started looking at it and it started to occur to me that, you know, as we make these increases in productivity, the theory is that we're all going to enjoy like cheaper things. Now you can go to Walmart and get things like much, much cheaper. You can get a hamburger at McDonald's for $1 instead of going to a restaurant, sitting down and paying $6. It's like, you know, you can consume a lot more at a lot less. That's what productivity increases do for you. But the other side of this equation is the one that I think we haven't quite solved. And that is when you increase productivity, you do reach a point where you just need fewer people to do the same thing. We're on the cusp right now of, and I'm not sure I completely buy this, but I think it's an interesting thought experiment to think about automated vehicles and the notion that we would put tens of thousands of truckers out of work by being able to ship things at odd hours overnight across the country without needing someone to drive. If you're a firm believer of productivity gains equaling increasing quality of life, this is a fantastic thing. We can drive down costs enormously. People who advocate for the driverless Uber cars or the driverless taxis, what they're saying is that we can cut the costs of driving somewhere enormously by taking the actual cost of the driver out. If you're someone who worries about, well, what is that driver going to do now? What is that truck driver going to do? How are they going to get paid? What are they going to be employed to do? We don't have an answer for that. And I think the problem that we struggle with today in our economy is we actually haven't figured, we've obsessed about jobs and we've obsessed about driving down costs through productivity. But what we haven't figured out is when driving down costs leads to fewer jobs, what do we do with those people? It's not enough to say, go back to school, here's a tax credit for education. It's not enough to say, well, you can go on disability and we'll pay for whatever. You see spiking in this country, suicides, depression, all the things that are kind of very closely associated with joblessness and not having like a real purpose. And I think we have not figured out quite yet in this economy how to give people's lives meaning and purpose outside of employment.
Yeah, I was going to add in any given state right now, the number one job that people have is truck driver. A lot of the things I'm reading, I know you're reading them too, say we're less than 10 years from the capability of putting a fleet of driverless trucks that would take the place of every semi you see on the road. Granted, it would take longer to unveil all of those trucks and get them all ready. But
and they would travel overnight, so they wouldn't create congestion.
Right, there's no resting issues. Yeah, you like know, they would
way better.
They
for
would
everybody,
operate on
right?
cruise controls. Everything's more efficient on fuel usage
right.
and the whole.
You're
thing.
Not gonna have someone falling asleep and crashing
right.
their semi.
Going to Duluth, yeah. Georgia instead of Duluth, Minnesota.
That might happen.
But then they're not stopping at convenience stores and getting coffee or buying something
right,
to eat.
Right.
And what
does
that
mean?
Well,
that's a whole person that's been removed from the economy. And so other things will be affected by that. But I would just point out, in the late 1970s, peak of iron taconite mining on the Iron Range, Mesabi Iron Range, we were producing a certain tonnage of ore. And then everything hit the crapper, so to speak, and through the 1980s. And by the time things had more or less returned and the mines were back operating again, they came back leaner. They came back with a third as many workers. And now there's probably almost 13,000 in 1980, and now there's just 3,000-some miners. And the number that blows people away, though, is that production of the ore never went down. We're producing the same amount of raw material, and our capability of producing the materials is the same or better. It's that there's fewer people. People still often think that because our economy, generally speaking, stinks on the range, that it's because the mines quit. They didn't quit. They're still running hot. It's that there are so many fewer people working those jobs, and the jobs are good, better than ever, arguably, safer, they pay well. A miner is now among the lower upper class of the Iron Range. But that's not just mining, though. I mean, that is happening in every kind of industry. And this idea of efficiency has gone to an extreme where it's the goal of even state government. I'm a state employee. I'm a teacher. And, you know, one of the factors that goes into our funding formula is the idea that I teach a class, and that me teaching that class, if it's more efficient than the average, if it costs less per student, then we are rewarded with more funding.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas if it's higher, if I'm too expensive for various reasons, you're penalized in the formula. My goodness. I mean, what's the goal of this? It's a chase to something that can never. You're always chasing the rabbit on the dog track, and you're never. I mean, what's the end game here? The end game is extreme efficiency with fewer teachers, more students in the classrooms, and some idea that the efficiency will somehow produce a result.
That is Aaron Brown talking about the idea of efficiency and questioning what that means in terms of jobs. You're listening to the March edition of Dig Deep on Northern Community Radio during our spring membership drive. If you appreciate this podcast, this online conversation, or this on-air conversation, give what you can to a local independent station that gives time to folks like Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone to dig deep. You can go to kaxe.org to pledge your support now. Chuck Marone continues exploring efficiency and resiliency.
Well, there's this trade-off, too, and economists talk about the trade-off between efficiency and resiliency. And, you know, we have obsessed for two generations plus about efficiency, and what you give up with efficiency is resiliency. We can see this in small towns with Walmart, for example. When Walmart came in, we welcomed them in most places. We cheered it. Now, all of a sudden, we had a broader selection of products. They were at a lower price. We didn't have to deal with the jerk who owned the hardware store who didn't like my dad in high school. You know, yeah. All those like small town little things, right? Like, we didn't have to deal with that anymore. But then all of a sudden, you know, we drove our downtowns out of business. We collapsed those local economic ecosystems. Now we no longer have the merchant class in town who get together and hold the parades and make sure Main Street is cleaned up. We don't have the group that volunteers at the high school and the boosters and what have you, because they're gone. They're either professionals now working 60 hours a week doing other things, or they're like deeply unemployed, or, you know, the night stalker at Walmart. We bifurcated our economy and we took out that like merchant class. What we did now, when we see where Walmart goes in and closes, now these towns collapse. Now they have, you know, the very little bit that they're hanging on to fades away. We, in a sense, had a policy of exchanging resiliency, the ability to adapt and change and be resilient, insurance, we could call it, for productivity gains. And the very tragic thing we see, particularly up here on the range, is that we now have neither. We're losing a lot of these places. And when the Walmart closes or the McDonald's closes or the strip mall, you know, goes out of business, what we find is that we don't have the adaptability and the ability to bounce back the way we once did. We don't have a depth in our economy. It's really, really hyper efficient and strung out, but not very adaptable. And a lot of that manifests in the types of jobs and the way jobs are created. We just got in Brainerd, we got a few years back a Costco. And it struck me, I was just kind of dumbstruck when it was announced and like the local paper put it on Facebook and all the comments. Like, oh my gosh, yes, high quality jobs. Yes, now we're going to have employment opportunities. And now, and it was almost like a city with a Super Walmart, a Target, a Fleet Farm, a Menards, a Home Depot, you know, multiple, all of a sudden now getting Costco would put it like over the top. Instead of just like another example of how we've kind of arranged our economy to cycle that capital out as quickly as we can and not have it cycle around and really not create the resilient type of jobs that our economy naturally created 100 years ago.
Yeah, I would just use the personal example. I've got small business people in my family, several throughout our family history. And like my grandpa's a good example. He's had businesses fail, and then he started a new one, and eventually one held up. And so that's, I think, what we're losing here. The idea that if you were knocked down, that you know, you'd be back on your feet and trying something else. You know, that merchant class you talked about.
We nostalgize that.
Yeah.
We if you ask Americans, they'll say that's part of who we are. But yeah, when you step back and look at it, it's really not anymore.
But not anymore. Because now when a franchise owner of a chain store or a chain strip mall shop goes under, they're gone. In many cases, the agreements they've signed to put that brand name on their business ruins them so much that they'll never work for themselves again.
Right.
You know, and that's the part where, you know, on the Iron Range, what do you want? Create jobs. How are we going to do that? Well, either we get a big factory. Well, they don't want to come. Well, okay, how about we use entrepreneurship? I talk about that a lot. That's a buzzword. Like, let's get people starting their own businesses. You know, what we're finding is after a generation or two of being out of starting your own business, you can't take people whose families worked for a big company for two or three generations and have them immediately understand what it involves to start a business and be successful and then acknowledge that, and they can't afford to fail because they have families. An entrepreneur, like a young person who starts a business and they might, you know, I failed seven times until I started Apple or whatever. That's great. That's an American story. But we're not set up for it in our small towns right now. A lot of the people you want to get out there and get, you know, come up with ideas, new ideas, they don't have the resources. And they also don't necessarily even have the expectation of support in their community because, you know, I think people like to check out things that are new for a little while, but then they go back to price and then they go back to efficiency because, again, I think that's what we're being trained for in our society, in our economic system, this idea that there's an efficiency. And you talk about how that makes people feel. Paul Grucco, a writer I really respected a lot from southern Minnesota, he was writing about agriculture, but he wrote about how there was a generation of people who were raised to believe that their parents lost the farm because they weren't good enough. Even though they were replaced by machines.
Right.
They weren't good enough. And so when you're raised to believe that the reason you're in your lowly state because your job was replaced by a machine or your parents' job was replaced by a machine, it's catastrophic to the way a community thinks about itself. I mean, I think about some of the communities on the Iron Range where I've lived and grew up. The biggest enemy is easily in the city limits of the town. People like to point at the Twin Cities or some political party, one or the other, actually both now. But the truth is the attitude inside the town, the self-defeating, we're not good enough, is the biggest problem we've got. So how do you fix that?
I completely hear you. And I'm going to throw something in here that I think kind of gets to this resiliency thing. I get in trouble sometimes when I talk about this because people misunderstand. When we look at the 70s and the early 80s, when women actually left in large numbers, left the home and entered the workplace. And I'm going to say right off the bat, I think it's great. And I think women working is a wonderful thing. And our workforce should have way more women in it. And they should be paid well.
Says the father of two daughters.
Yeah, yes. You're right. And my wife is, you know, a brilliant person who is doing great work. A lot of our expectation was that that would make our families better off. Like all of a sudden we would have more money. We would have more free time. We could take a better vacation. We could buy better clothes for our kids. What has actually transpired, and I think this is part of what's robbed us of our ability to do some of these things, what's actually transpired is we've gotten to a situation now where prices have gone up because of our buying power. Prices have gone up to where you cannot have just one family member work. You have to have dual income. If you want to participate in the economy at the level of a middle-class family, you need two wage earners. You need two people out there. Well, in past times, and I'm not suggesting that the sexist roles here were correct, but I'm talking about like the family dynamic. You could have one person try a business and fail, and then try a business again and fail, because you had someone else who could do a little bit of babysitting on the side, or, you know, bake some pies and sell them, or watch the kids so you didn't have daycare expenses and what have you. You had internally within a family a certain amount of redundancy and resiliency that we don't have today. Our families are stretched so thin that the idea of starting your own business is a huge risk. Our economies are stretched so thin that the idea of failing at something and having to go through a bankruptcy process is destructive. I mean, you've got 7 years now where you can't buy a house. So what we have done is we've taken entrepreneurship and made it a middle class and an upper middle class undertaking, when really in the past, entrepreneurship was a lower class kind of way to bootstrap yourself to something else. And we look down on people today and say, well, why can't you do it for yourself? Mm-hmm. Well, we've set our economy so you can.
That's Chuck Marone from Strong Towns. He's talking with Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown on Dig Deep. This is about the changing nature of jobs and resiliency. The idea of bootstraps, pulling yourself up, and entrepreneurship isn't a reality for most people anymore. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in to Dig Deep. Here's Chuck Marone.
Can I give a really quick example? Mm-hmm. Today, if you want to start a donut shop, it's like the lowest capital kind of thing you could do. You get a deep fryer and a counter and a cash register. You start a donut shop. Why aren't there donut shops all over the place? Everybody eats donuts. Everybody likes them. Why aren't they everywhere? I'll tell you why. Because you start a donut shop, you put your capital into it, then what happens? Dunkin' Donuts comes to town. And they get the subsidy from the city to run the sewer and water out to the edge of town to their place. They got the fancy new shop with the drive-through, and all your capital is gone. Do you know what you need to start a Dunkin' Donuts? You have to have a net worth, a liquid net worth of $500,000 in order to get a Dunkin' Donuts franchise. So what we have done is we have said to that small entrepreneur starting the donut shop, like, hey, don't bother, because you do it and we're going to wipe you out.
I was here in Grand Rapids, a Hardee's franchise just opened maybe a few months ago, and we... Okay, well, I'll admit it. I was there on the opening day. And the owner of the franchise was there. Now, is it a Grand Rapids business person who stuck their neck out and created a business? No. Guy's from Wisconsin. This is number 300 and
right.
However many. He's got hundreds of franchises all over the country. And that's because... That's what you need to have that money. And many franchises are that way, not just this one, I'm not picking on Hardee's, but all of them require this. To put the name on it, you need this large amount of money. We've seen it on the Iron Range with a lot of hotels, because you have to pay for the franchise fee to keep a hotel brand name on your sign. Well, they quickly figure out that the amount of business they're going to get is what they're going to get. It's not working. So they strip the name of the hotel. You know, we have the Chisholm Inn and Suites, which used to be a Country Inn and Suites. So they just stripped that Country out of there and put Chisholm, and they're still here years later. But that idea that we're paying for these franchise fees, because that's what our, as consumers, I think we've been trained to believe that the franchise stuff is the good stuff. So, and sometimes it is good. I mean, it's not, you know, it's just that you were talking about bootstraps. You know, I just had an interesting conversation with my mother about, I grew up in poverty, you know, and we were poor. I was asking her about a set of encyclopedias that my dad had bought us because I wanted to calculate how much of our income it was at that time for him to buy from a door-to-door salesman, bought these encyclopedias. About 3 weeks' pay that my dad put into a set of encyclopedias for his kids. It was tough. And the kinds of things you have to worry about and the kinds of mistakes you make making decisions about how to spend your money, you know, it was a really bad idea to spend 3 weeks' pay on a set of encyclopedias. Now, on the other hand, the reason I was asking about it is because I think those encyclopedias changed my life. You know, I read them cover to cover and got interested in learning. But that wasn't a safe bet. So when you have available capital, when you have the idea that something you do did something and kind of have that attitude, it's really easy to look at people in a lot worse shape and say, why don't you make the same decision? And in reality, a lot of those options that maybe you had aren't available anymore. You know, I think about things I did just in my, I'm 37, so, you know, things I did when I was starting out, I worked my way through college, period. I didn't have any debt. I was probably one of the last cats who could do that who was broke. And I worked through college in journalism. You know, that like a whole series.
Good luck repeating that, Joe.
Yeah, like, yeah. So if I saw a 16-year-old who was interested in journalism, who was me, just me, and I wanted to say, kid, you just do what I did, you'll be fine. And if you don't do what I did, you screwed up. It's like the available resources, the jobs aren't there, the money's not there, everything costs a lot more than it did. And so I think that's the part. We think about how things were. We don't necessarily know how they are. And I think just a generation separate, I even in my own lifetime, how I felt about money when I was a kid and we were broke and how I feel about money now that I'm middle class, I mean, you lose perspective pretty quickly when you're used to it.
You've been listening to Dig Deep. We'll continue this conversation on Friday as Chuck, our conservative commentator, and Aaron, our liberal commentator, will look at the future. They're going to give us some ideas that they have about jobs. If you appreciate conversations like this that go into the past, the present, and the future, take up issues having to do with unions and living in a rural area and transportation, that's coming up soon in our conversations on Dig Deep. Pledge your support right now to a radio station that gives time, gives thought to conversations like this. They're civil. They're people on both sides of the aisle, and they're talking about things that matter to us who live in small towns. Call to pledge your support now, 800-662-5799. It's Dig Deep. I'm Heidi Holden.